My name is Chris Deasy. Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My guest this week is Ian Dale, LBC radio presenter, commentator, blogger, author, and former parliamentary candidate. He was also the chief of staff for David Davis. We find out which type of interviewing he absolutely detests, and Ian reflects on how it used to be a challenge for him to interview people he knew well. He says he can get more out of someone through the soft form, non-confrontational interview, and he likens David Frost's interview style to that of Lieutenant Columbo. Ian reflects on his recent LBC interview with John Bercow, and also the interview he conducted with David Amos 6 months before he was murdered. We find out which former Prime Minister Ian is still waiting to interview. At university, Ian studied German linguistics and teaching English as a foreign language. And Ian discusses how he has a lot of freedom in the type of radio he does. He discloses why he doesn't like wishy-washy centrist elections, why the Falklands War was the big sliding doors moment of his life, and how setting up a Conservative Association at the University of East Anglia was a defining moment for him. We talk about shy Tory syndrome, why Ian has been called the thinking man's Brexiteer, how his time at LBC has knocked off the harder edges of his views on social issues, and we find out what would have happened if Ian had been elected as an MP. We learn how he came to do a podcast with former Home Secretary Jackie Smith, why on Twitter people still see Ian as a diehard Tory, though he has voted for other parties, and has recently called for the nationalisation of P&O. At the end of the interview, Ian talks about Brexit derangement syndrome on both sides, and we learn that he is a naturally nostalgic person, and Ian also explains what the test is of a good friendship. I was so grateful to Ian for coming to the University of Kent campus to record the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is a great pleasure to interview Ian Dale this afternoon. And Ian, I think it's like the boot on the other foot, because you're the one who normally does the interviews.
Well, it's poacher turned gamekeeper, yeah. Or gamekeeper turned poacher. Yeah. I'm never sure which one
yeah.
it is.
Yeah. Although I was recently interviewed on my own podcast. And so I was thinking, hang on, am I asking the questions or answering them? Somebody's asking my questions back to me. And of course, you're very well known for your work on LBC and your blogs, your book on the Prime Ministers, and a parliamentary candidate. In fact, you always seem to be on the Jeremy Vine show. You're everywhere. You're ubiquitous.
Am I? It may seem like that to some people. I suppose it depends what you watch or you listen to. I can say no. Contrary to popular rumour, my partner says, can you just not learn to say no to things? Why do you always have to be busy, busy, busy? And I say, yeah, but you don't know all the things I say no to. And I say no to a lot of television nowadays because I don't actually enjoy television particularly. I do it because it brings people into the radio show, which is my main thing. So if there are television things that come up that I don't want to do, I just do say no.
And I always find, particularly on TV, that you've got 5 minutes to do an interview, yeah. perhaps, and you're trying to consolidate somebody's life into yeah. a matter of minutes. I find radio interviews, and obviously the podcast particularly, is a good way of ensuring that you get much more out of the person. And obviously you can learn a lot more in an hour than you can in 5 minutes, but it always feels when people are at film festivals or they're promoting their latest film, they'll say the same thing to each person who's interviewing them. But do you really get much out of the person? Is that person there to talk about themselves?
Well, if you look at the way politicians are interviewed nowadays, for example, in the morning, that a cabinet minister will probably do 10 to 15 different interviews. Well, you're not going to say something different in those. So I find them completely sterile. Yeah. It's part of the reason why I've never wanted to present a breakfast show, because I'm just bored by that. As a listener, I'm bored by that. Whereas being in the evening, which is not considered to be a sort of prime time slot in radio, you've got much more time. If I want to interview somebody for half an hour or an hour, I can do so. And you get much more out of people, because think about it this way. If you're a politician going into a 4 minute interview, you've probably got one or two things that you want to get across. And you will get those things across no matter what you're asked. And the presenter also is under pressure from their editor or their managers to get a news line. And if they're not getting the news line, then they go for a gotcha question. And I hate that kind of interviewing. I just absolutely loathe it. So this kind of interview, for example, yeah. where we'll probably do an hour or more, you can really get to know somebody. If as the interviewer, you let your interviewee speak, after the first 5 or 10 minutes, they'll have run out of the pre-prepared sound bites. You can actually get into their soul, know what motivates them, where they're coming from, what they want to achieve. And I think people like that. And the long-form interview, I think, is now really re-establishing itself, not just on the internet, but also in traditional broadcast media, which 5 or 10 years ago, you wouldn't have got the opportunity.
Yeah. And do you find that with politicians, for example, that you know, and, you know, David Davis is an example, when you interview them, I mean, obviously, if you know, there are obviously things that you'll be talking about that are relevant to the news of the day, something that's happened in Parliament, for example, but are there ever occasions when you've known somebody or thought you knew them, but in the course of an interview or at the end of the interview, suddenly you go into sort of territory that feels far more, maybe more human, the sort of thing that The Breakfast Show would never cover? And are there those sort of occasions where you still have the capacity to be surprised, which, of course, in itself then makes the interview worth doing in the process because it's not the breakfast TV fodder?
What I've worked out over the years is that if I've got the time, I can get people to open up in a way that they haven't done to other people. And that, it's almost regardless of whether I know them or not. Because when I first got into radio, what, 12 years ago, I would find it quite a challenge to interview people that I knew or people who were friends of mine. I don't have that issue now. And David Davis or Brandon Lewis, who are probably my two closest friends in politics, they both think that I give them the hardest interviews of any interviewer that they experience. And they think I overcompensate because I know them. I don't think I do. I mean, there may be something in that, but I don't think I do. I just try and treat them the same way as I would anybody else. I can't say I've got a particularly massive revelation out of David Davis, but just because I know him. But because the politicians know that I've been on their side of the fence. So I'm not saying they think I'm a soft interviewer because of that. Although some people do think I'm a soft interviewer because I generally don't shout at people. I'm not rude to people. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there have been examples where I have been, but most of the time, I think you get something out of someone if you treat them with at least a modicum of respect, rather than doing what Jeremy Paxman used to say, sort of, why is this bastard lying to me? I understand that they have a job to do. They understand that I have a job to do. And, I mean, I'm not going to describe it as a game, but it is in a sense, because I know that I've got to give them the opportunity to let them say what they want to say. But then I'm going to go in, if I think they're trying to pull the wool over my eyes, I will go in quite hard. Before we started, you mentioned the interview I did recently with John Bercow. Yeah. And I generally don't prepare for interviews very much because I think it's better to be spontaneous. But that one, I knew that he would quote things back at me and I had to have my ducks in a row. So I read the whole report that described him as a serial liar and bully. And so I had my ammunition ready to go back at him. And I wasn't looking forward to that interview, I have to say.
And what was obviously the interview went on for however long, but...
Well, it was meant to go on for 10 minutes and it went on for 17.
Yeah. And between the two of you afterwards, because he'd obviously been on the media that day and, you know, referred to it as a kangaroo court and so on. Mm. But was there a palpable sense between the two of you that this was not a very friendly sort of episode?
Well, I've known John Bercow since I was at university. He was at Essex, I was at UEA. And we've run into each other over the years. I published a book that he wrote on tennis, believe it or not. Yeah. And I was just itching for him to sort of say, well, because he'd said in one other interview something like, well, I haven't got time to do something or other. And I was going to say to him, yeah, but you had time to write a book on tennis, didn't you, while you were speaker? But unfortunately, he didn't say it. He knew that I wasn't going to go in soft in this interview because he knows that I have said things in the past about his handling of all the Brexit situation in the Commons and wasn't very impressed by that. But I think I was fair to him. I did accuse him of patronising me at one stage. At the end, he shook my hand. We parted and I sort of said, give my regards to Sally, his wife, because I used to do paper reviews with her. So I don't think he... I don't think he can have enjoyed any of the interviews that he did that day. I mean, if you're accused of that sort of thing, even if you think you're completely innocent, which he does... you kind of know what's coming.
Yeah. And I always feel with some politicians, you mentioned, presenters, I should say, Jeremy Paxman you mentioned, and John Humphrey's another one, they can be quite aggressive. And of course, they're in a different sort of class in the sense that they know that that's the expectation, that you know, people know that a Jeremy Paxman interview, you know, if it isn't confrontational, people will feel disappointed. But of course, if the boot's on the other foot and they're the ones ever being interviewed, I think of John Humphrey's when there was the episode with the BBC China editor, he really hated it when there was a journalist outside his house from the BBC asking him questions. It was really sort of very disparaging in a way that he didn't like the fact that he was the one being asked questions, because it's okay when he's the one being aggressive. And I do agree with you. And I think of someone like David Frost who would ask very clever questions. And, you know, there was one classic one with Margaret Thatcher, and she was slightly just, you know, off balance, because he asked her whether she had been more difficult with John Major than Edward Heath had been with her. Like, who's the biggest thorn? And she had to think about it for a minute, and then she said, but I didn't treat, you know, John Major badly, etc. But I think sometimes with an interview, there has to be some sense of reciprocity between the two people.
Yeah, you mentioned David Frost there. I mean, I can't say that I've modelled myself on anybody. I kind of do my own thing. But I was always really impressed with David Frost's style of interviewing. It wasn't a sort of gotcha style. Yeah. And he got criticised for being a soft interviewer, but he always got the news lines. And he was a bit like, do you remember the, now for younger listeners to this, they won't get the analogy here, but there used to be an American detective series called Columbo. And he was very clever. Well, obviously it was a drama, but he was very clever in, you'd think he'd be interviewing somebody about a crime and he'd be in their house and you think, well, he hasn't got much information out of that. And he'd walk to the door and then he'd turn around and say, just one final question. And that would be the killer question. Now, David Frost was brilliant at that. And I know that I've kind of adopted that, because it's very frustrating sometimes for my producers if we've got a half hour interview and by minute 25, I've got no news line. It might be an interesting interview, but no real news line. And the number of times the news line has appeared in minute 26, 27 or 28, I mean, it can't just be coincidence. It's just, I think that people, if you're having a conversation rather than a formal interview, people relax into it. Yeah. After 5 minutes, all the sound bites have gone. And as I say, if you let somebody talk, that they might say something interesting. And that's always been my approach to things. Yeah. And I think that works.
Yeah. I was reading an interview somewhere, an article about, I think it was Geoffrey Howe. And apparently he always liked to do the Today programme at 5, you know, the interview at 10 to 8 rather than 10 past 8, because he knew that whereas the 10 past 8 interview could overrun and maybe he could be wrong-footed and they could just, you know, keep going at him, he knew that they had to stop for the weather or the sport or so on. So, of course, he knew strategically that he always had the last word, because he would just out-talk Brian Redhead or whoever was interviewing him. So that was very, very canny. But have you come across sort of situations like that where you feel that the person that you're interviewing is trying to perhaps either preempt what you say or to avoid a particular conversational line?
I mean, they can't really out-talk us, because if I'm doing a good interview, I will go over the news. Yeah. I mean, you're not supposed to do that, but I've done it a lot. And the longer you're on a radio station, the less likely the management are to really give you a bollocking over it. So I do take liberties with that. I mean, the John Bercow one, for example, I think I went to the break at about 7:54, bearing in mind there'll be another one at 8 o'clock, so you only have then a three-minute quarter. Now, that's not a normal thing that you would do, but I just felt it warranted it. And my producers are very accommodating on that. They know, I mean, a good producer knows the inside of their presenter's brain like nobody else. And they know what I'm good at and they know what I'm not good at. And when I'm doing something that I'm not good at, they will intervene. But generally, they let me do my own thing. Yeah.
And do you choose who you get to interview? I mean, you must have, obviously, contacts and connections. But is there a sense in which you will personally contact somebody to get on the programme? Or is that all in the hands of the producers?
Well, I always get in trouble in answer to that kind of question, because I think that I am a producer's dream as a presenter, because I do some of their job for them in terms of getting guests. And they would happily admit that. Now, it depends on what the programme is. Now, my programme at the moment is divided into three separate hours. The first hour is a phone-in, but it's quite a newsy hour, lots of guests, so you might only get three phone calls in. And you want a couple of good guests at the beginning of the hour. Now, they tend to book that hour themselves without any input from me. The second hour, cross-question, like any questions, I do have an input into that. And it's usually more to say, well, I've never heard of that person, why are we having them on? And then they come on and they're actually really good. And so there's that trust relationship between the producer and presenter. But we have sort of special hours. For example, we're recording this in the middle of March 2022, yeah. And the Chancellor's Spring Statement is coming next week. I've spent 18 months trying to get Rishi Sunak to do an interview with me. Not only is he going to do an interview, he's going to do a phone-in on the day of the Spring Statement. Now, that is unheard of. Yeah. And that is where I've put in the hard yards, I've put in the graft to get that to happen. And then the next day, we're doing Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, exactly the same thing. We did last week on Cross Question, instead of having our normal range of guests, we had three Ukrainian MPs on, female MPs, all because I happened to know Alicia Kearns, the MP for Rutland and Melton, and she'd got them over here, and she said, would you like them on your programme? And I thought, well, what a great idea. Yeah. So you trade on your contacts an awful lot, and you can work on getting a particular guest on for years sometimes. Yeah. I mean, there are people that I still haven't. John Major keeps saying yes, but we never managed to get a date. So, I mean, you're never going to get anybody. And there is a certain, if I'm honest, there's a certain degree of competition among programmes. Yeah. Some presenters have no input into their programme at all in terms of guests. Others do. I mean, Andrew Marr's just started at LBC. Mm-hmm. I imagine he's going to open his contacts book up quite a lot. But I come after Andrew Marr. I want to have as good guests as he does. Now, I'm not saying I'm going to get them just because he's there. I would have got them anyway. But that's part of my role, I think, to make sure that my programme has the best range of guests possible.
And it's funny you mentioned John Major, because the one that stands, I think he did two with Simon Mayo. And of course, then he was talking about the things that come to mind is when he's talking about The Happening, the song that he remembers, I think, when he was very young, the Supreme song. And also, he was very keen to talk about cricket. And I think maybe it was sort of stipulated that this would be an interview more about the non-political side of his life. Mm. But I always thought that was an interesting side and always really enjoyable because I think Joe Phillips was saying the same thing, that now that he's no longer in office, John Major is such a fascinating figure to listen to because, of course, he's no longer having to represent a particular constituency or have particular MPs he has to keep in line. And he comes across as an elder statesman, which, of course, he is. So in that sense, if you were interviewing him, I can imagine that you'd have a very enriching conversation with the whole, it's 30 years since his time as Prime Minister.
Yeah, and the difference between interviewing someone on the radio and interviewing them on a podcast is that there is... On the radio, there is a pressure to talk about the news of the day or a big issue that's happening over a period of time. But actually, you really want to talk about their life and their career. Yeah. On a podcast, you can do that to your heart's content. Yeah. And I love having... I mean, David Amos I had on my podcast 6 months before he was killed. And he was just full of anecdotes, and it was great fun. And I mean, obviously, when he was killed, that everyone sort of turned to that for other broadcasters. I think he used quite a bit of footage from it. And I also like interviewing people who maybe weren't household names as well, because everyone has a story. And if you can sort of eke it out of them... On my All Talk podcast, I did one with somebody I know through West Ham, who nobody's ever heard of, but he's just had an interesting life. We did 2.5 hours. We could never do that on the radio, certainly with somebody that nobody had ever heard of. And I think I've done about 200 or 300 episodes of this podcast now, and it's still in the top 10, even though he's not a household name by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. And I also like doing people who maybe have been quite well known 10 or 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I'm doing one in a few weeks with Nina Mishkov, who, I mean, people under the age of 30, 40 might not know her. But she was the Simon Cowell of her day. And a fascinating figure. I did the Jeremy Vine show with her the other day, and I said, do you want to come on my podcast? Yeah, I'd love to, she said. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, no, you're right. I remember her in the late 80s. She was the person, she'd be on the talent shows.
Yeah.
And she'd always be the one who was the more abrasive. I'm sure she was lovely, but of course she was the one who did what, as you say, Simon Cowell did on X Factor. But are there any particular dream, you mentioned John Major, but are there any particular interviewees that you'd love to have that, you know, and not necessarily from, you know, today's generation, you mentioned Rishi Sunak, but is there anybody from maybe the, like, you know, the Ken Clark or somebody from a few decades ago that perhaps would be able to talk about maybe, say, the Conservative Party in a wider historical context?
One person that I don't think I've ever interviewed, and I think he's now too old to do this sort of thing, is Douglas Hurd, who had a really interesting career, first as a diplomat, then he was Ted Heath's private secretary in his government, then obviously a Conservative MP, held various cabinet positions, ending up as Foreign Secretary, nearly became leader of the Conservative Party. Yeah. People who've had been there, done that, and I sometimes think I ought to think a little bit more about that and interview these people before they, shall we say, depart this world.
Yeah. Well, and that kind of was the inspiration for this podcast, well, one of many, of going to funerals of people and discovering in the obituary or in the epitaph, you learn about somebody that you thought you knew well as a colleague, and suddenly you think, you know, there was one colleague who clearly in his later years not very happy in his job, but suddenly had this wider hinterland, interest in cooking or travel and opera. And suddenly I thought, why didn't we ever have those conversations? So I think when I started doing the podcast, it was always trying to really get to the very heart, to do justice to somebody, rather than just sort of deal with, you know, we're dealing with a big sort of restructuring at work at the moment, and of course people are always talking about that. And a few years ago it was Brexit. So, you know, the idea that suddenly you just associate somebody with one particular ideological or sort of political view, I think that's really important. But maybe it's worth just going back to the very beginning in your case, because obviously you've been doing the LBC thing for a number of years. But how did the journey start for you? I mean, I'm guessing that this wasn't necessarily something that you imagined that you'd be doing a couple of decades ago.
I was always really interested in the media. I studied German linguistics and teaching English as a foreign language. So I intended to be a German teacher. When I was at university, I got involved in the TV station there, and I used to be the newsreader on a Friday lunchtime with a girl called Anne Wood, and we would sort of be the Jan Leeming and Richard Baker, but we would corpse every single day, every single Friday, and it got to be a sort of cult thing, and you could only watch it if you were in the student union building, but it was quite a good training. That there was no university radio station, but I was always fascinated by radio, and I listened a lot to Radio Broadland, which is now a heart station, and they had some great presenters on that. And there was a woman who did an overnight show, or maybe at late night, Mary Jane Cullen, I think her name was, and she just had this most wonderful silky voice for overnight radio. And I always thought that's the kind of show I would like to do, a sort of late night. I mean, I've got quite a sort of soft voice, which in some ways doesn't lend itself to speech radio, because particularly if you do a breakfast or a drive time show, it has to be pacey, 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 whereas my voice is not like that. And I remember when I started the drive time show on LBC, which I did for 5 years, they tried to really zhuzh me up. And I kind of resisted this in a way, because I thought, I can't do something that sound, it'll sound fake.
Yeah.
But Louise Burt, who was the deputy managing editor at the time, she used to come into the gallery just before I would go on air. And to zhuzh me up, she would scream into the microphone behind the glass, "Big bollocks!" And it worked. And that immediately made me sort of much more animated than I otherwise would. So I kind of tried to play the game, and I'm trying to do it with my voice now, just be a little bit faster, a little bit more pacey. I don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah.
And so I didn't make any effort to get into radio, because I thought I was going to be a teacher. Now, I then went into working in the House of Commons for a couple of years, became a lobbyist, ran a couple of companies. And it was when I opened Politico's bookshop that the media stuff started. Because we'd have film crews come in or radio people to record some atmosphere or interview politicians in the shop. And I started to get on the Sky News pay-per-view circuit. And then Jo Phillips, who you've interviewed on this podcast, she used to come into the shop all the time. And she said, would you like to be one of the presenters on Sunday Service this week, which is a programme on Sunday mornings on Five Live, a political programme, but quite quirky. And Andrew Pearce, who was the normal sort of right-of-centre presenter, he was off, so I deputised for him. And I absolutely loved it. Yeah. And I kept thinking, somebody's going to offer me a radio show as an artist, but they didn't. And I did about, I don't know, 20 of those. But nobody came knocking. So I sort of gave that up, really. It was a bad job. And I was then trying to become an MP as well. It didn't work out. But I didn't really ever think that I would be able to get into radio from then. And then in 2009... And I apologise to people who've heard me tell this story on other podcasts, but hey, it's important to the story. Yasmin Alibi Brown, who's a good friend of mine, she rang me up and she said, oh, I'm doing an audition for LBC. And I had been on LBC quite a few times a few years before that. And I said, well, how do you do that? I want to do it. So she gave me the guy's name. He knew who I was through my blog, that I was one of the more famous bloggers in the early, in the 2000s. So he said, well, why don't you come and do a joint one with Yasmin? And I thought, well, that's a good idea, because we'd done Sky together quite a lot. So we went and did this 20-minute fake programme, and it was a disaster. I mean, you kind of know when something hasn't gone right. So I it was like a fake phone-in, so the producers would pretend to be the callers. And the thing that Yasmin is brilliant at is punditry. What she found more difficult was the radio bits, the sort of teasing up to the news and all of that kind of thing, so talk, going into weather or whatever. And I just thought, we're never going to hear back from them. Anyway, 3 weeks later, they rang me up and they said, oh, Petrie Hoskins ill tonight, can you come and do her programme? I said, oh, with Yasmin? And they said, no, just you. Mm. Which was a little awkward, but in fact, just before we started this podcast, I got a text from Yasmin saying, are you still okay to come to dinner on the 27th? So you can tell that the relationship has survived that. Yeah. And she comes on the show. So I did a few cover programmes. And then the following summer, Petrie was off for a month. So I did her show for a month. And I knew it was going quite well. And people kept saying to me, oh, they're going to offer you a permanent show. And I thought they'd offer me a weekend show or something. But they didn't. They offered me the evening show. They said, Petrie's going to go to the afternoons. We want you to do the evenings. I was thinking, how can I do that? I've got a full-time job. And it wasn't just a full-time job. I owned the company. Yeah. Anyway, we worked something out. And I started in September 2010 and have been there ever since.
Yeah, because I always found, growing up, and it's a generational thing, I think, because my children do not listen to the radio. And they find it slightly peculiar that something like a live event would be something that you'd, you know, listen to and say, right, it's time for Pick of the Pops or whatever, you know, whatever the program might be. For them, you know, it's a world of YouTube, or you know, they'll watch something when they want to watch it. Yeah. And that, maybe looking back, that's the sort of thing that I wish I'd had when I was younger, because if you missed it when it was on, that was it. You know, there was no way of getting it back. You didn't have streaming in the 1980s. But there was something about, and there's still something about live radio. Whether I'm in the car or if I'm at work, there is something so exciting about knowing that you have a professional, but you never quite know with a live programme what's coming next. And a really good presenter will play off that. Sometimes you know when the presenter, if it's a radio, if it's a music-based programme, you know if they're not playing the jingles, or you know that somebody's advising them and you know, doing everything in the producer's booth, etc. But it's the liveness, and when they play off that, and when they're good enough to go in almost without a script and they could just speak for an hour without, you know, it wouldn't matter if the technology failed, they could see it through. And that has always stayed with me. So from a very young age, listening to people like Tony Blackburn, Ed Stewart. So, you know, I'd be at university. People my age were not really listening to that sort of thing, but it was the skill. What really worked is the fact that they were so professional. It wasn't even what they were playing. It's the fact that they'd have somebody on to do a phone-in or an accumulator quiz, as Ed Stewart used to do in the afternoon. And he just made it sound like it mattered more. You know, he did Crackerjack, didn't he, in the 70s? But it just had that same, every day, he would be doing his bit with such infectious enthusiasm that you were listening in for that. And I just don't see these days, anything that quite, and obviously some of those presenters, not Ed Stewart, are still very much alive and still doing that. But of course, they're in a way no longer at the cutting edge. They're no longer maybe mainstream. And I think that there's something really missing. I think radio...
I think you're talking about music radio than anything else. Sure. And music radio has become very formulaic. Yeah. The presenters generally have no influence over the music that's played. And they have to say the station's name, yeah, every single link that they do. The links sometimes often are pre-scripted. And I think, how can anyone get any enjoyment out of that? And I don't have a script. I go on, I say my stuff. I think people think we do have scripts, but I certainly don't. I used to write a few things in the early days, but I know that I'm better when I'm just being spontaneous. Mm. And I don't get any guidance. I don't get any editorial instruction on, well, we want you to talk about this, we want you to promote this kind of line. It's entirely down to me. I am effectively the editor of the programme as well as the presenter. So my producers might well come up with phone-in subjects, but if I don't want to do them, they know that it's not a good idea to do them. Because if I'm not interested in the subject, or I think it's going to be a really difficult subject to get calls on, what is the point of doing it? You need to have your presenter engaged in the subject and have an opinion on it. And of course, when people join LBC, and they've come from an environment where they are not expected to hold opinions, it's either quite refreshing for them to be able to utter opinions for the first time, or it's a terrifying thing for them to do. Because I don't understand how people can't have opinions. I mean, if you're interested in the news and politics, why wouldn't you have an opinion? But if you've worked at the BBC for 20 or 30 years and had to suppress opinions, you can't expect someone to come into a station like LBC and then immediately become the most opinionated person in the country. I mean, Andrew Marr's just joined. We're recording this 2 weeks after he's joined. And, I mean, he has become... I mean, you can tell that he has become more opinionated, but I suspect the Andrew Marr that we will hear in a year's time... it's probably very different from the Andrew Marr that we're hearing now, because you can't just sort of switch it on and off. You have to gradually get used to the environment.
Yeah. I think there's such authenticity in, for example, what you do, because this is just, 2 days after the P&O debacle, literally, you know, just down the road from where we are in Kent. And you, I think, was it at the start of the programme where you just, you know, gave a very clear, off-the-cuff, four-minute sense of what was wrong. You talked about nationalisation, you talked about whether, the, you know, legally what P&O did was clearly was wrong. And there was something in that, and I thought, and you're right, compared to, say, what the BBC could do, because they're, you know, whoever's presenting the programme is going to be delivering the same sort of line. But you're a brand. So, you know, you listen to Ian Dale, or now, of course, he's only just started, but with Andrew Marr, and you had Eddie Mair before him. There's a sense in which the presenters, in that sense, have a very clear, you know, everyone knows their background, or, you know, it's not, you know, for example, if you're interviewing David Davis, it's obvious that, you know, you're his campaign manager and so on.
No, I wasn't. I was
just chief of staff.
If I'd been the campaign manager, he might have won.
But isn't that the interesting bit, though, that in all of this, that, you see, nobody, it came up in my profession, because if I'm writing a book, it's easy to think, I'm writing the book now, there's a war on at the moment, but in 10 years' time, people who read that book will not be aware of that particular context. You want to make it timeless, universal, so students in 10 years' time will read it and not feel that there's out-of-date material. But inevitably, everything works within a context. So you couldn't interview John Bercow or David Davis without some sense of why you're the one asking the questions at that moment in time, and the fact that maybe you know them in another context is, you know, so there's a sense that anybody listening to this will think, oh, you know, Ian's position on Brexit is such, and this person has a very different position. So if they go off on one, how are you going to respond? So that must be far more liberating than you might find on some of the other broadcasts.
Well, I think it is. On the other hand, what I refuse to do is to have an on-air rant for the sake of having an on-air rant. I'm not a shock jock. Yeah. If I have a strong opinion, I will give it, as I did on P&O, as I did on Priti Patel's handling of the refugee crisis. Mm. But I can't do it to order. I mean, I remember, this is some time ago now, my producer said in my ear, so just before, I think this is actually when we were doing Drive, can you have a rant after six about whatever the subject was? And I said, no. They said, oh, but digital want it for the website. It'll get a lot of clicks. And I thought, I remember saying, we're not the effing Daily Mail. But you know that you have to play that game a bit. I mean, you can't just sort of, we're not Radio 4 either. We're not, I mean, people joke sometimes saying LBC stands for LB Serious, let's be serious. And that there is a bit of that sometimes. I try and lighten it up quite a lot. But I couldn't possibly present my programme for an every hour, get angry about something. Because I'm not angry about everything. And there are things that make me angry. And yet, it's like, we're going back to interviewing. If in every interview you become shouty, the listener's bored by that. Whereas if you get shouty once a month or once a week, they sit up and take notice. Oh, what's got into him? Why is he being like that today? And there have been times in a couple of occasions in recent weeks where I've been in a bad mood for some reason and the listeners pick it up. Yeah. Now, that's not a reason necessarily not to be in a bad mood. Because everyone gets in a bad mood sometimes. So why shouldn't a radio presenter be in a bad mood? Well, you don't want to make it so people don't want to listen to it. But if I have a bit of an argy-bargy with a few callers when I'm in a bad mood, people can find that quite funny. But they wouldn't necessarily want it to happen every night. Yeah.
Do you know, I was just reflecting on that because if it's Prime Minister's Question Time, then the Leader of the Opposition obviously has a job to, you know, whatever the story of the day, they're going to find an angle and they're going to say how terrible the government is. And sometimes, no doubt, over the recent Partygate, I'm sure that Keir Starmer was profoundly angry at Boris Johnson. However, if every time, you know, then in that adversarial exchange, the government can never do anything right, if the opposition is always going to pick holes in what the government are doing, you have a situation which was very common. I mean, 1992 was the first election which I ever voted. A lot of my friends at university were not all that interested in politics. It was a case of, well, whoever you elect, they're all the same. Now, I don't think people say that so much these days, but there was that sense that whoever you're voting, it's all a bit cosmetic. I don't think it is. I mean, Neil Kinnock had very clear principles, as did John Major, but there was a certain perception that the opposition are going to oppose and the government are going to defend, so they're not interested. But when you have a genuine moment when a government is perhaps rightly on the ropes, then I think people will sit up and take notice. But something has changed in the last 10, 15 years. Brexit and Trump have certainly exemplified that. But no longer is it the case that people would say, is there an election? I don't care. The 2010 election, I remember talking to my students about it, and I don't think any of them expressed any interest. Whether they voted or not, I don't know. But I remember talking about the Nick Clegg and the Gordon Brown and David Cameron. And generally the feeling was one of, well, it's not really something that matters to us in our lives.
I think that's always been the case. I don't think that was anything particularly different. I mean, to get people interested in an election, there has to be a threat from somewhere. 2019 was a clear example of this, where everyone knew that if Boris Johnson got in, they may not have liked him, but they thought that he would get Brexit done, to coin the phrase. If Corbyn had got in, I mean, people didn't necessarily know what to expect, but they feared what might follow. And there was a clear choice there. And this is the dilemma in politics, where the electorate on the one hand say, oh, you're all the same, we want to have a choice. And then in the other, you can knock on one door and somebody will say that. You knock on the next door, oh, why can't you all just get along? And you think, well, the two things don't meet. It's got to be sort of one thing or the other. I like there to be a clear choice in politics. I think where it's a sort of wishy-washy centrist, and that doesn't inspire anybody. And where people know what the outcome is going to be, they're less likely to vote. You look at 2001 election, where the only thing we ever remember about that election is John Prescott punching somebody. No one can remember anything else because everybody knew Tony Blair was going to win. Yeah. And he did, by virtually the same majority as he did in 1997. Elections, good elections, tend to be those that have a certain degree of unpredictability about them. And one of the things I love in my job is having now done four election night programmes. and just seeing how far we've come from 2010, when I hadn't even joined LBC, yet they allowed me to do the election night programme effectively with a band of bloggers. And that would never happen now. Whereas in the last election campaign, it was all singing, all dancing. About 50 people took part in that programme behind the scenes. We had amazing graphics. We had Martin Stanford doing his sort of Peter Snow, Jeremy Vine role. We had three studios. I mean, it was an amazing experience to be part of, and being the co-presenter of it was fantastic. Doing American election programs as well. So what I love about this job is that there's always something to look forward to. You know that it's not just the sort of your normal program every night. You've got election nights. You've got some outside broadcasts. There's always something new that is coming along that challenges you as a presenter. Because I never want to get to a point where I'm coasting. Because I think there are so many people do that in broadcasting, and that's not me.
Yeah, and probably impossible in your case, because you have so much of an investment in this that you're not just doing this as a sort of, you know, another job will come along tomorrow. You know, this is in a way ideally suited to you. It's and you actually have a stake in it. It's not, well, you're not just, they're not random interviews.
No, they're not. And I know that when I finish at LBC, and we all know as presenters that there will be a time when sort of you either leave of your own volition or you get red carded. Mostly the latter. And I mean, I'm not stupid. I've been there 12 years, so I'm probably nearer the end than the start. But I know that when I leave LBC, I won't be going to another radio station because I couldn't do what I do anywhere else. The BBC would never employ me, even though there are programmes on the BBC that I think I could do. And other radio stations after LBC, would I want to go to them? I don't think I would. So I'm 60 in July, and when you have a landmark birthday, you do start thinking, okay, well, what's the next 10 years going to bring? And the honest answer is I don't know. I still think I'm doing really good shows on LBC, and I want to continue doing that. But I've really got into book writing now. Not sure I'd want to do that full time, but I've always had this sort of portfolio of things going on in my life, and LBC for the last 12 years has been the sort of mainstay of it and provided most of the income. But I like doing it. It's a job that allows you to do other things as well.
Yeah, and we'll go forward in a minute, but just as certainly the theme is nostalgia, just going back maybe even to university, I'm interested that you did languages and you were thinking of becoming a teacher. Do you sort of look back on that and think that maybe there was another career path that you could have followed? It sounds as though you've done, you know, it's hard to imagine how you could have done something as good if you'd followed that line as you're doing now, because you're very much in the know. You clearly have a real stake in this, a real passion for what you're doing. But so do you want to say a little bit more about what you did at university, what you studied, and what you imagined the future would bring?
I think we've all had sliding doors moments in our lives where one person or one incident has had a long-term effect on what we do. And I suppose mine was probably the Falklands War. That's only just come into my head as the defining moment where I went to a debate at UEA on the Falklands War, imagining it would be a debate between somebody who thought that the government was right and we should send a task force, and somebody else who thought the government was wrong. What it turned out to be was a debate between the hard left and the soft left. And I was sitting there getting pretty angry about what was going on, because nobody was putting forward the case for retaking British territory. So I got up on my hind legs and put the case and quite enjoyed it. And I then, the guy that was next to me in the residences, Dave Larg, we just hatched a plot to, at the Freshers' Fair in the autumn of that year, to start a Conservative Association. And that was really what set me on the path to politics. To cut a very long story short, we got more members than the Labour Party did. The Labour Party at UEA were absolutely delighted, because instead of fighting the trots, they could fight a real enemy in the Conservatives. And it was a fantastic year, and it was the year of the 83 election, where I got really involved in that election campaign and ran the Conservative campaign in Norwich North in a pretty rough council estate. And I went to the count and saw the ballot boxes coming being opened with, I mean, you wouldn't believe the number of Conservative votes were coming out on the campus. And UEA was a very left-wing university in those days. Conservative posters in all the residences, far more than Labour ones. And it was really exhilarating to be part of that. And I remember in January 1980, was it four? Must have been, maybe it was 80, I can't remember. Anyway, I got invited to a reception at number 10 by Margaret Thatcher. And I mean, I come from a small village on the Cambridgeshire borders of Essex. My dad was a small farmer. I was not born with a silver spoon in my mouth by any stretch of the imagination. And for me, as a 21-year-old, driving down to London in my yellow Ford Cortina Mark III, in a three-piece suit that I'd bought for the occasion because I didn't own one, and that really meant something. And so I remember walking up the stairs of Downing Street, you know, where there's all the pictures of former prime ministers, and then seeing this little figure at the top, Margaret Thatcher, because she was literally 5'4", and really small. And she would grab you shook hands with her, and as you shook hands, she guided you with her hand into the room so you didn't stop and basically hog a conversation. And I was just thinking, oh, my God, all the cabinet are here. It's Norman Tebbit, Cecil Parkinson. That must have been 83 then, because he was still in the cabinet. And I remember walking out of there, sort of almost floating on air, thinking, oh, my God, I'm part of this. And when I got a job in the Commons with the MP for Norwich North when I graduated, I remember on my first day walking through the corridors of the House of Commons and encountering former Prime Minister James Callaghan walking down the corridor with former President Gerald Ford. And I just thought, what's a boy from Essex doing in a place like this? And that feeling of slight wonderment has never really left me. And I've always slightly suffered from imposter syndrome, if I'm honest. I didn't go to public school. I didn't go to Oxford. And I didn't have that inbuilt confidence and resilience that people who've been to those places have. And it wasn't till I was probably in my late 40s or early 50s that it wasn't a chip on my shoulder, but it was a sort of feeling of slight, I'm not quite as good as them. That went around that time. So if I was in a group conversation, say with George Osborne, Nicholas Bowles, David Cameron, Ed Vasey, I would always sort of slightly be the shrinking violet. Yeah. That stopped then. I don't know what made it stop then, and it may be because I think when you get to 50, you kind of know what you're good at, you know what you're bad at, you know what your character flaws are, you know what your strengths are, and it may have just been the fact that I got this job on LBC and just knew that was what I was put on this earth to do. So I would have loved being a teacher. I think I'd have been quite good at it. I would have probably found it quite frustrating in many ways. There wasn't really, I mean, I'm trying to think back, and because I mean, I was brought up to be a farmer, because the oldest son always becomes the farmer. And had I been born 10 years before I was, I probably would have been. But I kind of knew from a very young age that really wasn't what I wanted to do. I mean, I did work on the farm. I helped my dad a lot, and I quite enjoyed driving the combine harvester. I didn't enjoy ploughing. And I feel very lucky that I had a perfect childhood with two wonderful parents who supported me in everything I did. And they must have been disappointed when the penny dropped that I wasn't going to go into farming. Yeah. But I remember I spent my gap year in Germany, and my mother told me later that when I walked up that escalator at Harwich to get on the ferry, she thought she'd never see me again. She thought that was it. I was off. But I've always been a sort of home bird and always been very family oriented. And I mean, she would, like, every time I would appear on television, I would then ring her up afterwards, and she would tell me how brilliant I'd been, even if I hadn't been. Yeah. That's what mothers are for. And I remember the first time I did a Sky pay-per-view after she died, I went to phone her.
Yeah.
And then realised I couldn't.
Yeah. Do you know, it's funny you mention imposter syndrome, because so many people I've interviewed have said the same thing, including some people who you think have got it made, you know, and you imagine somehow that they were always destined to do whatever they're doing at a young age. Yeah. And maybe they're overcompensating in some way. No, what you said was really touching, because there is that sense. I mean, I only know many of the people I talk about through their Alistair Campbell's diaries. You know, it's riveting. But sometimes when you then read, say, an autobiography, and you realise that you may know more about something than the person who wrote it. I remember reading Harriet Harman's autobiography, and there were lots of things in there. When she, at one point, she seemed to think that Roy Hattersley was deputy leader in 81 or something, or there was something that the whole chronology seemed out. And I thought, oh, you know, how could that have, you know, passed by? And I think sometimes you then realise that you have a particular sort of niche. And sometimes it might be, as you say, being in, you know, on the broadcasting side of things rather than in the, you know, the front line, because you could have been an MP in, was it 2005 that you were, yeah, you know, that you would have been elected. And what you were saying about the left-wing nature of a university is so interesting, because one of the in the university where I was in Lampeter in West Wales, it was very, again, left-wing. This was early 90s, a lot of anti-Tory sort of feeling. But the president of the student union in my first year is now a Tory MP. And that's Carl McCartney. Is he the Lincoln MP? Yeah. And suddenly I was like, how did that happen? But I didn't know him very well. I think he would have been a student before I went there. So it was his sabbatical. So he was the president in my first year. I don't think I ever even spoke to him. But I just assumed, maybe naively, that in those days, everybody was either a Welsh nationalist or was Labour, because those were the dominant voices. But then you sort of look back and you realise that maybe a lot of it was, or maybe he always was a conservative, or maybe he just needed to suppress that in order to become popular.
There's a lot of what's called shy Tory syndrome in universities, where, and I think that's particularly prevalent today, when if you say that you're a Tory, you may well be shunned.
Yeah.
And I think it's not just by fellow students, but by professors and tutors, which I think is appalling.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you can't have a free debate in a university, where can you? That's what universities are there for. I think that people often don't want to publicise their political views. I mean, there were a lot of shy Brexiteers. That's why a lot of people in the media didn't see it coming.
Yeah.
Because they felt that if they expressed their views, they would be traduced for it.
Mm.
And that was the case. And it's a bit like in America. People didn't understand how Trump could win. Well, because there are a lot of unhappy people out there, but they may not have admitted to an opinion pollster that they were going to vote for him.
And on the campus where we're doing the interview now, back in 2016, I didn't meet a single person, unless, of course, they weren't telling me the truth, but who intended to vote for Brexit. It was very much sort of, you know, we want to stay in the European Union. And then in Canterbury, as in other parts of Kent, more than 50% of the people voted to leave the EU. And that was kind of an awakening, because suddenly you realise that there's the university on the hill, quite literally, the ivory tower, the experts, the intelligent people. Suddenly, we were not the ones who were saying, this is how you should vote. We weren't leading. We were following. And I think what an awakening that was.
Well, I'm not so sure it was. I still think that most of the people who were shocked by that are still shocked. And they've made little effort to understand why it happened. It's why Labour continue to lose, because they don't really understand why they've lost for the last four times. And there seems to be no willingness to learn from history. And if you don't learn from history, you repeat it.
Going forward, I mean, when I think about nostalgia, I always think of it as a very, you know, it's bittersweet. There's a sense that we're looking from the vantage point of the present at maybe a rosier past, which may have been not so rosy in actuality. It's the idea of the past. Are we trying to reclaim something from childhood? Is there something from when we were young that we want to recapture and move forward? You know, I suppose it's Trump's Make America Great Again, the sort of, we had it great once and there's no reason why we can't get it back now. But is there a sense, sort of looking back, that you're inclined to accentuate the positive? Are your memories predominantly positive as you survey your life and career?
My memories of my childhood and young adulthood are absolutely mainly positive. But my memories of Britain as a country in that period are not wholly positive. I remember the three-day week. I remember having to use candles at home because the power was off. I remember the terrible strikes and the terrible secondary picketing that went on. And I remember Britain being an economic basket case. And I remember going on a school exchange to Germany and being embarrassed by the questions I was being asked by my German host family. I mean, they seemed to think that we were some sort of third world country, and they were right to a degree. That changed in the 80s. And I mean, I'm not going to pretend that the last 5 or 6 years haven't been difficult. And I've struggled with it as a presenter in a way, because although I didn't campaign for Brexit and I didn't even tell anyone how I'd voted until after it had happened, the narrative has grown up that I was one of the main Brexit cheerleaders, because after it happened, I would appear on lots of programmes defending it, partly because very few other people did. And those that did were slightly swivel-eyed people. And I remember saying to a Newsnight producer, I said, well, I'm very happy to come on your programme for the third time this week, but can't you find other people? And they said, well, no, we think of you as a thinking man's Brexiteer. Well, I've been called far worse than that. but I don't pretend that there are things that have happened over the last 6 years which have made me slightly uncomfortable. I still would say that, I mean, I would still vote Brexit again if it happened now, and I will defend it. And it's, for me, it was never all about economics. It certainly wasn't about immigration. And I always thought that there would be some difficulties. Now, because of COVID, we don't quite know exactly the extent of what those difficulties have been. I mean, there are some that you can easily identify. But I still believe that in the long term, it will prove a good thing for this country. I think I've become... LBC has changed my political views in some ways. I still would self-describe as centre-right, but I think on a lot of social issues, the harder edges have been knocked off me, and that's because of callers. When you talk to people about their own individual experiences, and when you have three middle-aged men in a row on a phone in on Universal Credit crying... I mean, you can defend things. I could sit here and defend the bedroom tax to you. I could defend the theory of it, but I can't defend the practice of it. And that's where I always wonder what kind of MP I would have been, whether I would have been somebody who would have been the male equivalent of Nadine Dorries and sort of been a bit of a gob on a stick. Now, I mean, she's in the cabinet now. Or whether I would have been somebody who would have wanted ministerial office and been prepared to make the compromises that you have to get it. And I still don't know the answer to that question, because my natural temperament is as a maverick. But I know that mavericks don't change the law. You have to slightly toe the line to get the credibility within your own party, within your own government, to have an impact. And it's a very difficult tightrope to walk. And I'm sure there would have been some things that I just couldn't have stomached and would have ended up resigning over. So we will never know.
Well, I'm thinking as well, because you obviously have the respect of people on other sides of the political spectrum. Jackie Smith, I mean, you do a podcast with her. I mean, I get this. There's obviously a rapport between the two. Did you know each other well before you worked on the podcast, or did you sort of meet through the podcast?
No, we met back in 2009. She was Home Secretary. And I had been commissioned by GQ magazine to write a profile of the two Miliband brothers. And I went to spend a day with David, and he was Foreign Secretary at the time. And there was some big meeting of civil servants in the Foreign Office, and Jackie was addressing them. So he said to me, oh, come along. And then to my horror, he introduced me to her, because I'd said some pretty robust things about her performance as Home Secretary. And I could tell by the look on her face, yeah, I know who you are. And then came the expenses scandal. She resigned. And then I asked her to do an interview with me for Total Politics magazine. And I think we talked for about 3 hours and just kind of hit it off. And I then suggested to Sky News that we should do paper reviews together. And it kind of all stemmed from that. And I always thought she was very shabbily treated. And I won't say it was because I felt sorry for her, but I did make a conscious effort to try and help her. Because when she lost her seat in 2010, I mean, I thought, well, there's nothing so ex as an ex-MP, particularly one that's been through the mill of the tabloid newspapers. So we sort of developed a bit of a friendship. And then I suggested starting the podcast. And that was in 2017. And we've become really close friends since then. And she's a genuinely nice person, has become one of my best friends.
Yeah, because it's always interesting, because I'm reading the Alistair Campbell's diaries from the period, was it 2007 to 10?
Yeah.
And I'm on 2009 at the moment, so it looks like I'm at the point where she's going to resign. Yeah. And I think that whole period is interesting, because you've got Alistair Campbell's take on this as somebody who was very close to Tony Blair, but also was trying to resist, you know, going into Gordon Brown's government, or you know, to try and spin to win in 2010. But what unfolds to there is what's going on behind the scenes, the people in the public eye, but then the people who may privately say things to him. David Miliband, a good example, who appears a lot, who wasn't necessarily saying very positive things about the direction of the government under the Prime Minister of the day. And that sort of humanising of politics is something which I really warm to, because I think sometimes it's very easy to see, and maybe necessary from a point of view of an election, to see things in very black and white terms. You need binaries, but sometimes those binaries don't work, because then you feel a sense of betrayal if somebody, I don't know, Douglas Ross, maybe that's not the best of example, of somebody who was calling for the resignation of the Prime Minister, but has now about turned. And maybe he's right to do that because of the war on at the moment, but it, sometimes you feel, you know, is this a point of principle, or is this somebody trying to exploit a situation? And I think sometimes I'm far more interested in those politicians or presenters, whoever they might be, celebrities, once they've finished doing what they're doing many decades later, when they're free to say what they want without sort of worrying about what the whips might say. And it sounds as though you've got, with Jackie Smith, that kind of a dynamic, because, you know, neither of you are in office, in government, neither of you are having to toe a particular party line. And I think in that respect, you probably get the best out of the both.
Well,
of yourselves.
I think that's why the podcast works. Yeah. But of course, you look at Twitter and people still see me as a diehard Tory.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
I mean, it is a difficult balance to strike, because I mean, I have voted for five different ways in the last 10 years. Admittedly, in every general election, I voted Tory, but I have voted for other parties I've never voted Labour. I can't imagine the circumstances that could ever happen. And sometimes you vote because you're as a protest vote. It's like, I think my local Tory council in Tunbridge Wells is terrible, so I'm not going to vote for them. So I'm not a diehard Tory in that sense. Yes, I am. On economic issues, I'm still centre-right. On social issues, I would probably describe myself as more centre-left, if those terms even mean anything anymore. And it does frustrate me when people just automatically assume that on a particular issue, I'm going to spout a government line, because I ought to make a list of the sort of 99 occasions when Ian Dale has spoken out against the Conservative Party, because I could probably easily get to 99. I mean, I call for the nationalisation of P&O. I mean, I would never have thought I could call for the nationalisation of anything. But, I mean, I articulated my reasons for it, and I still would stand by that. But for diehard Tories, they will look at that and think, oh, another example of Ian Dale becoming a lefty.
Yeah.
My producer had a text in the middle of my rant on P&O the other night, and he said, I love it when Ian Dale goes a bit commie.
but there must be a lot of people who you went to school or university with, assuming you're still in touch with many of them, because they know you, and obviously everybody evolves over time, and I'm sure people who knew me at school or university, I'm on Facebook contact with many of them. But is there a sense in which people who know you from a different part of your life, Does that sort of integrate well with the Ian Dale persona that these people, as you mentioned, who sort of see you as a diehard Tory, will, you know, rage against on Twitter?
I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, I am still in touch with some people from those years. Mm. I'd like to think that I don't think my character's changed. Mm. I mean, I've always been a blubberer. I mean, I cry at Emma Dale or something like that. I think I've always had a lot of empathy. But as I say, I think some of the harder edges have maybe been knocked off in recent years. And I do occasionally, I'll get a message from somebody who says, oh, I don't know if you remember me, but.
Yeah.
And I say, well, of course I remember you. What are you doing? And I love having those conversations. I mean, and that's where social media is fantastic. There's a guy that I used to know in my gap year, who was an English language assistant in Hamburg. And I remember going to stay the weekend with him once, and he shared a flat with a male prostitute, which was a sort of revelation to me. And I couldn't remember his surname. And I just put on Twitter, Ray, 1983, Hamburg, English teacher. Anyone know where he is? Within 30 minutes, yeah, we were DMing each other. Yeah. And you think that is just where social media is a real blessing. I mean, it can be horrible. I mean, I've had so many horrible incidents on social media. And if I say anything about Brexit, if I say, there's two or three subjects where if I say anything at all, I know that I can't look at my Twitter feed for 3 days. Because it just goes into a very horrible place.
Mm. And that's why something like Facebook sometimes can be an important way of doing something where you wrest control of a narrative that, you know, at the moment, of course, it's what's going on in Ukraine. We see, obviously, with COVID as well. Sometimes there needs to be a different sort of steer. Because otherwise, if something is packed with animosity, I know some people who will, you know, particularly during the days of Brexit, were, you know, constantly just ramming the point that they hated the direction that Theresa May's government was going in, etc. And sometimes it was interesting to see people who seemed very calm in their other pursuits. I mean, academic friends in different universities, and suddenly, you know, they were actually, you know, you mentioned swivel head in relation to particular parts of the Tory party, but there were some people who were doing the same from the left of spectrum as well. And I just thought sometimes, you know, I don't want to play that game.
Well, people got Brexit derangement syndrome on both sides. Mm-hmm. And it, Alistair Campbell admitted it to me, and Andrew Adonis has as well, sort of on that side of the fence. But there were plenty of Brexiteers who could not understand the Remain argument at all. They essentially thought that Remainers were traitors.
Yeah.
And when you have such entrenched views like that, it's very difficult to have a rational debate. I remember a year or 18 months ago, I said, we haven't had a Brexit phone in for a long time, but let's madly, I said, let's do another Brexit phone-in. And it was as if we'd stayed still in 2018.
Yeah. Yeah.
You got the same people ringing in, uttering their moronic defences of their viewpoint. Mm. And I thought, do you know what? I'm not interested in doing this anymore. It's a bit the same with COVID. Mm. It will get to the same with Ukraine, where you will get these sort of slight Russian apologists who say, when you start talking about the Russian action, yeah, but what about America? What about Israel? I think, no, we're talking about Russia here. And my temper is easily lost with these people, I'm afraid.
Yeah. And would you say, as we start to wrap up, Ian, would you say that you're a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I'm not going to say that I'm a looking forward type of person, really, because I never know what's the next year's going to bring. And it's probably just as well in some ways, particularly after the last couple of years. I am starting to think about, OK, well, if I'm 60 this year, how long have I got left? What do I want to do with those years? So from that point of view, I suppose I'm starting to look forward. I'm a naturally nostalgic person. I like to find forgotten photos of my family, that sort of thing. I like to meet up with people that maybe I've lost touch with, often through my own fault rather than theirs. I think, if I'm honest, the last 20 years, I've not been a very good friend to some people, in that because I've led such a full-on working life, I've let quite a lot of, I mean, not like really good friendships lapse, but there are only so many hours in the day. And so one day you think, I must ring so-and-so. Then the next week you think, I haven't rung them. Well, I'll do it tomorrow. And by the time, you know, a year's gone by, and then it's a bit embarrassing. I mean, Jo Phillips was a bit like that, where she and I would go to West Ham sort of every other week. And then she moved out of London to Whitstable. And I went to see her just before we've done this podcast. But that was only, I think, the second time this year that I've seen her. And I still would regard Jo as a really good friend, even though we haven't seen each other very much. My best friend is in America. I haven't seen him since 2012. But the test of a good friendship is when you, even if you have a 10-year gap, it's as if that, when you meet them again, it's as if that gap hasn't happened. And you just pick up exactly where you left off. I remember in 2015, I went back to Germany to, I was at the Frankfurt Book Fair, and I thought, well, I'm going to go and see the family that I used to stay with. And their son, Jochen, who was my first pen friend, I mean, we were really close, but you live in different countries. And I was dreading seeing them again, because partly because I wondered if my German was still going to be up to it. But again, with his mother, with him, it was as if the intervening years hadn't taken place. And that kind of gives you a really warm feeling.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you've maybe now go to my university reunion in July. It'll be the 200th year since my university was founded, and 30 years since I went there as a student, with a new sense of optimism, because that's exactly what I found testing the waters on these things, meeting people outside of the context in which you knew them, and then discovering that you're just picking up on conversations from where you left off. That's really important. The worst thing is when you discover that the people that you knew or thought you knew now have a very different type of way of looking at the world, different personality. And of course, sometimes you think maybe there is a case for leaving the past where it is.
I think the regrettable thing is that I've found, certainly in the last few years, when I've had a much higher profile, people then are reluctant to contact you because they think that you must be so busy and they don't want to bother you, they don't want to trouble you, whereas actually you'd really love to hear from them. I've had a few of those where you have to explain. It's like, actually, my sisters, because I constantly complain, well, you never ring me, it's always me ringing you. And their response is, yeah, but we know that you might be on the radio, or you might be, I mean, we don't live that kind of life, so we just assume that you'll be too busy to take our call. I mean, I accept that up to a point, but...
yeah, well, that's a perfect way to end, because, Ian, I'm just thinking that when I learned that you were coming here and we did the interview in person, I was just thrilled, because I thought, you know, I see Ian Dale on the television, him on the radio, he can't possibly have time to do a podcast with me. But this has been a wonderful
Well, I just think when you do a podcast like this, you can do it remotely. And actually, when I'm doing your role here, when I'm interviewing people, sometimes it's actually a good thing. And I find that I can say something to somebody when I'm not looking them in the eyes, that if they were in front of me, I might slightly hesitate to. It's like Jackie Smith and I, we record our podcast remotely. And, I mean, we get a bit, shall I say, smutty from time to time. And I'm not... On the few occasions when we have done it face-to-face, I'm not sure I would be as willing to go as far as I sometimes do. And I think she feels the same in that. So it's a very strange dynamic, this, isn't it, in some ways?
Yeah, but no, Ian, it has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for being my guest this week.
I've very much enjoyed it. Thank you.